welcome to the Human Flourishing Project. I'm your host, Alex Epstein. When I started this podcast, I talked about the problem that most bothers and fascinates me in the world, which is that human beings lack reliable access to the knowledge we need to flourish. And my ultimate goal with my work in general and with the Human Flourishing Project in particular is to create reliable access to the knowledge we need to flourish. And this is a very, very big project involving a lot of different facets. Now, one area that I'm particularly interested in and have been thinking about directly or indirectly over the last 11 or so years is how do we get the knowledge we need to flourish in the realm of technology? And in particular, how do we evaluate complex, controversial technologies? You can think of artificial intelligence, genetic engineering. Those might be the two most controversial technologies. But even things like smartphones, Facebook, these are issues where there's a lot of seeming potential for them to improve our lives, and certainly a lot of claims that they'll make things much worse. So how do we make sense of them? Now, many of you who've listened to the show or who are familiar with me know that I've spent the last 11 years focused on one issue above all, one technological issue above all, which is what are the right answers in terms of energy technology? And even within that, what are the right answers with respect to the dominant energy technology of civilization that many, many people are very afraid of and have negative views on, namely fossil fuel energy, or more concretely, hydrocarbon energy. More technically, I should say, hydrocarbon energy, since it really refers to energy made of carbon and hydrogen atoms primarily, and whether what the legitimacy of fossil origin is a secondary and not super, super important question. So I've been thinking about it for 11 years, and over the last year, when I've been thinking about the Human Flourishing Project more broadly, I've become reinterested in the hydrocarbon issue because the more I started thinking about how do we get real knowledge about every technology, it made me start to think more about the fossil fuel issue and how do I get even better knowledge about that. In some ways, I think I've thought of it in a clearer way than just about anyone, but it's still a really complex issue. And in particular, it's got a lot of scientific complexity going on because we are trying to make predictions about how adding more CO2 to the atmosphere is going to influence the climate system, and that is a very complex thing to get. And then there are all sorts of economic things in terms of, well, how beneficial are fossil fuels economically? Can they really be replaced by different so-called renewable technologies like solar and wind? And you hear lots and lots of claims about that, and those can be hard to sort through as well. So in the last 6 months or so, I've been thinking about this issue of how do we get real knowledge about technologies, particularly how do we evaluate complex, controversial technologies. And I've been thinking about that specifically with the issue of fossil fuels the most because that's the issue I know best, and that is thus the issue that it's easiest to try to develop a more universal framework for evaluating complex, controversial technologies. So what I thought I'd do today is share some of my progress there, my progress specifically with the goal of developing a framework for evaluating technologies. And I'm going to focus on energy technology, but I'll also mention examples of how this applies to other technologies. And I hope you see that this is, or I hope you agree with me, that there's a lot of potential to apply this to anything that's controversial in the realm of technology, and hopefully it'll give you some immediate tools for processing and thinking about all the different kinds of claims we hear. So what I want to do for the bulk of today's show is to tell you the story of how I've come to develop a certain framework about thinking about technology applied to the fossil fuel issue, and then indicate how that applies to other issues. But first, here's an attempt to quickly give you some background on how I became interested in the fossil fuel issue, and particularly from the perspective of being very frustrated that the mainstream, what I would call knowledge system, the cultural system for helping us know the truth about complex issues and making decisions about complex issues, how I became very, very dissatisfied and really lost fundamental confidence in it, and then what I did about that. So going back to 2007, really trying to make a long story short, I was researching the career of John D. Rockefeller for an article I was writing about basically whether the media properly represent businessmen. And I was studying the case of Rockefeller, who had this famous biography, the history of the Standard Oil Company by Ida Tarbell. And there was this general idea that Rockefeller was this bad guy. I had a lot of reason to suspect that that was a misrepresentation. So I ended up looking into Rockefeller, and to understand Rockefeller, I really needed to understand the oil industry, and in particular, what the oil industry was like before Rockefeller and what the oil industry was like after Rockefeller, so I could see the nature of his impact. Anyway, once I started getting into that, what I noticed and didn't expect to really care about was what I learned about what the world was like before the oil industry, and to put it in my favorite terminology, what human flourishing was like before the oil industry in particular, and then what it was like before the fossil fuel industry in general. And the short version of it was that the world was very poor and had mass suffering and death by our standards because the world was very disempowered. And what I realized about energy is this is no ordinary industry, if there is such a thing, because this is the industry that powers every other industry. This is the fundamental empowering mechanism of human flourishing, at least in the material realm. So made me really aware of the importance of decisions that are being made about energy, because decisions about energy are leveraged because they affect the total empowerment or lack thereof of a society. They affect how good we are at producing clothing and shelter and food. And the more energy we produce, all things being equal, the more empowered we are, the more we can flourish materially, and then the less energy we have, the machines either don't come into existence or become useless, and we become a manual labor society that's very, very disempowered. Now, I became fascinated by the positive potential of energy, but of course, I was well aware and previously even more concerned about the potential negatives of the leading energy technology, which is fossil fuel energy or hydrocarbon energy. I'll use those interchangeably. So we have this issue where this is a technology that's central to our way of life. And there's also a situation where billions of people still lack any kind of significant access to energy. So there's this very high positive potential of using more fossil fuels or something equivalent, but it's been hard to find something equivalent. And at the same time, there's this huge potential negative, particularly in the realm of climate, in terms of making the whole planet, some people would claim, uninhabitable, to the point where billions of people's lives would be worse. So you have this is the kind of thing we hear on other issues, where there are these very big potential benefits and very big potential risks, and we need help making sense of them. So where do you go to get the most accurate possible assessment of benefits and risks? Well, the default in a society is you go to the mainstream, and I think of it as the mainstream knowledge system. And the way this works is that there are specialists in all kinds of fields that are related to the benefits and risks of fossil fuels. So there are specialists in energy technology, in economics, in climate, in pollution, in resources, in terms of are we going to run out of fossil fuels, that kind of thing. And there are all kinds of different specialists. And then there are more generalists, more issue analysts, whose job it is to synthesize the best information and ultimately to give us a good overall assessment of fossil fuels, both the benefits and the risks. And then we have a cultural knowledge system, which we can think of as mostly the media educational system, including all sorts of different institutions, but, you know, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. And then their job is to be aware of what all the issue specialists have figured out and synthesized, and then to bring it to our attention so that we have good knowledge. So this is how the knowledge system is supposed to work. And I can't say that I had any kind of undying faith in it, but this was basically, you know, this is the starting point, because you need a lot of specialists to get to the bottom of an issue like that. You can't just say, oh, well, I know what's going on with fossil fuels and climate. How are you going to know? How was I going to know? So that was the starting point. But then I started getting into it. And in particular, what I did, and it's probably in part because I had started out with the history of it, which turned out to be very valuable, I started learning about and getting very interested in the history of thinking about energy. And in particular, I became interested in what is the track record of the different thought leaders. So you can think of this as the thought leading specialists, the thought leading issue analysts, the thought leading institutions. What is their track record in terms of giving us an accurate assessment of both the benefits and the risks of fossil fuels? And in particular, I was interested in, you know, what's the track record with this issue of environmental destruction in general, and then climate in particular. And as I started studying, really focused on the 70s and 80s, what were people saying back then? What were they predicting? And I was a little bit surprised and definitely dismayed to learn that there's been a 40-year track record of claiming essentially what the mainstream claim is today, which is that fossil fuel use is going to create imminent environmental catastrophe and therefore should be radically restricted. So fossil fuel use is going to create imminent environmental catastrophe and therefore should be radically restricted. This was the view. And this is the view today. But I learned, well, this was also the view in the 70s. And in the 70s, there were two particular strains of this, one which has come a little bit out of fashion because it was so obviously wrong, and then another one where the just the dates on the predictions have changed, but that in and of itself is a real problem. So the thing that kind of came obviously wrong was the idea that we would run out of fossil fuels, that we needed to force ourselves to get off them very quickly because we were going to run out of them. This was a view by people like Paul Ehrlich, who's one of the world's leading ecologists, John Holdren, another leading ecologist who became the top science advisor to President Barack Obama. And there was a whole narrative, and this was spread throughout the New York Times and whatnot. And it was, we're running out of oil, we're running out of everything, we need to become more sustainable and renewable, we need to radically restrict fossil fuel use. So that was one kind of strain. And then the other strain, which people are surprised to know has been going on so long because it's presented as new, is the idea that because of CO2 emissions from fossil fuels, we face imminent climate catastrophe. And then for that reason, we need to radically restrict fossil fuel use. So these were the two arguments for radically restricting fossil fuel use based on the idea that it was causing imminent environmental catastrophe. So when you claim something is imminent, when somebody claims that in the past, then we can look at the track record of that. And then when I looked at the track record, now I knew that it was obviously wrong to some extent, but it was really shocking how wrong it was. Because essentially since the 70s, early 80s, mid-80s, what has been predicted is if we continue on our path of using fossil fuels, which we shouldn't, we need to radically restrict them, then life is going to get much worse because we're either going to run out of fossil fuels or we're going to make our climate uninhabitable or both. So this was the prediction. You have predictions like John Holdren, 1 billion people may die of climate-related causes by the year 2020, which is, this is 2019, it's next year. These very extreme kinds of projections. And if you want to know more of the history, check out Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, Chapter 1, The Secret History of Fossil Fuels, where I document a lot of what thought leaders have been saying. So what was supposed to happen is if we kept using fossil fuels, life would get much worse. That was the basic message that thought leaders communicated. And in fact, what happened is we doubled fossil fuel use since the 70s. And so that means life should have gotten much worse. And then when I looked at, well, what actually happened from a human flourishing perspective, and that's going to be really important because people, I don't think, I know we're not thinking sufficiently from a human flourishing perspective. What actually happened as we doubled fossil fuel use is that life got way, 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 way better overall. And there were at least two big dimensions to this. One dimension was that billions more people became empowered. And this was a combination of people in the wealthier parts of the world consuming even more energy, which gives them a lot more wealth and a lot more time to figure out new things, which then leads to all sorts of other science and technology. So there's a huge increase in the rich world's standard of living by being able to use more and more of this cheap, plentiful, reliable source of energy. But maybe even more dramatic is the rise of billions of people from total poverty, particularly in China and India, because they're going from a manual labor society that has essentially no machine energy use to societies that industrialize where they can then get machines to do their work for us. And you have just dramatic jumps in all sorts of different quality of life metrics. Now, there are also certain drawbacks, at least to the way it's been executed. But it's interesting that those drawbacks are what are highlighted, even though things like life expectancy, income, health, these very fundamental metrics of human flourishing, those are dramatically up. And it's interesting and revealing that the focus has only been on, well, this, you know, the air in the cities is polluted. But even with that polluted air, people's health is, say, much, much better than it was decades ago. So we have this just phenomenon of life is predicted to get much worse, and yet it gets much better. Now, then one could say, oh, well, but maybe, you know, maybe the predictions were just delayed. Like they were a little bit too early, particularly on the climate catastrophe predictions, but those are still going to come true. But the interesting thing there is that from an environment, not just from an overall human flourishing perspective, but even if we look at environmental quality in terms of human beings having a livable environment, that's gotten way better overall over the past 40 years. Things like clean water have gone up. The amount of resources that we have access to hasn't gone down. It's gone up. And most surprising to people is that we're far safer from the climate than we were 40 years ago. And the reason is not that human beings haven't impacted climate at all. It's that we've overall impacted the livability of our climate in actually a very positive way, because I like to say nature doesn't give us a safe climate that we make dangerous. It gives us a dangerous climate we need to make safe. And human beings have figured out how to deal with things like extreme heat, extreme cold, droughts, floods. These are natural phenomena, even if they are at all being amplified by human beings. The fundamental thing is, do you have the capacity to deal with these phenomena at all sorts of different levels? And once you have a lot of energy and a civilization, you can start to deal with almost any climate problem. And before, you're vulnerable to any climate, even the most kind of nice, perfect imaginable climate is a big threat to your life. So what's happened is there's this phenomenon of life. We were told by the thought leaders that using fossil fuels would cause environmental catastrophe, and so we should radically restrict them. And in fact, we didn't listen, and we used a lot more fossil fuels, and in fact, life got worse, and in fact, our environment got net better, mostly because the fossil fuels allowed us to master our environment, to take the naturally dangerous environment and make it a lot more hospitable to human life. And so that's where we are today. But then there are still real concerns, including, well, has the climate thing gotten worse, and where is that going to take us and whatnot? And it's, you can't just say, well, they were wrong in the past, so we're not going to listen to any experts in the future, because you need experts. So what do you do? And this I found to be very frustrating, because the real question is, how do I get an accurate assessment of fossil fuels today when I know that the knowledge system doesn't work? There's something very off about a knowledge system that tells you if you do X, life is going to get much worse. And then you do X or you do 2X and life gets much better. And if here's the key part, if you hadn't done X or 2X, if we hadn't used fossil fuels, if we had radically restricted them, basically guaranteed with what we've seen with technology, billions of people would have much shorter lives. Our lives would be much worse. But certainly people in China and India, billions of people around the world who have been empowered would have stayed disempowered just because there was no scalable, globally available source of cheap, plentiful, reliable energy that wasn't fossil fuels. So we have a situation where the thought leaders who are helping us evaluate technologies have a track record with this technology of giving us literally deadly advice. And yet we still need specialists and we still have to take seriously potential threats that, you know, either new threats or old threats that weren't exactly the way they were predicted, but might still be a real issue. So how do we do this? Well, I come to this from the perspective of, at least I came to this initially from the perspective of someone who knew very little about energy and the associated environmental issues, but who has been obsessed since he was a teenager with the issue of thinking methods. And when I see large groups of smart people get something very wrong, I become very interested in what went wrong in terms of their method. I think many people think in terms of intelligence and, oh, these people are smart, these people are dumb. And I tend to think in terms of methodology. These people have good methodology and these people have bad methodology, or these people have mixed methodology. And that's now, of course, if you're smart and have good methodology, then you have more power. But if you are smart and you have bad methodology, then you actually have a lot of power to do negative things. So I thought it's worth thinking a lot about what is the right methodology for assessing or evaluating a technology, and then how have thought leaders deviated from that. And I became pretty interested in this early on, let's say 2007, 2008, but I've become more and more interested in it every year. So what I'm going to give you now is my more mature assessment of what I was only gleaning back then. And this is, I think of this as the human flourishing framework, or my human flourishing framework for evaluating technology. So what I want to share is the key elements of this framework as it currently exists in my mind, and then how that applies to the fossil fuel issue, and then a little bit how it applies to other issues. But I'm going to give a quick overview, and then I'm happy to elaborate in future episodes if people are interested. So here's my summary of what it means to accurately assess a technology. And if we're looking, you know, we're asking society, we're asking thought leaders to give us an accurate assessment, we should know what one looks like. There's a question of what does one look like, and then how do you know that a particular person's is accurate? So here's my summary of what it means to accurately assess a technology. And if I were to put it in two words, it would be full capacity. But I'll give you a few more than two words. An accurate assessment of a technology is an understanding of its full capacity to impact our values. An accurate assessment of a technology is an understanding of its full capacity to impact our values. And full and capacity, all of these words are important. I'm going to elaborate on different aspects of them, but I stress full capacity because, one, the full implies I want to know everything crucial about its ability to affect our values. So with, say, fossil fuels, I want to know about positive potential impacts and negative potential impacts. And with vaccines, I want to know about positive potential impacts and negative potential impacts. And with Facebook, I want to know that. And with smartphones, I want to know that. I certainly want to know that with artificial intelligence or virtual reality or self-driving cars or genetic technology in the human realm or genetic technology / GMOs in the food realm. I want to know, I want a fullness about it. And then I really like the term capacity because before we talk about what we want to do with a technology, what the right decision is, I want to understand its capacity or potential, because there are lots of things that have different capacity to do good and to do bad. And often there are ways of maximizing the good and minimizing the bad. But I can only do that once I understand the full capacity to do good and bad to impact my values. And I think that often people jump to, oh, I'm going to evaluate the current way we use fossil fuels, or I'm going to evaluate the current way we use Facebook. And that is relevant. But the key thing we're trying to decide for the future is, how should we use fossil fuels or not? How should we use Facebook or not? And that requires getting at its full capacity. So I think of an accurate assessment as an understanding of its full capacity to impact our values. And then from that, I have four concepts that I think are essential to having that kind of accurate assessment of something's full capacity to impact our values. So the first one, so I'll name them and then I'll elaborate. So the four are human flourishing standard, that's one. Two is even-handedness. Three is precision. And four is explanation. So human flourishing standard, even-handedness, precision, and explanation. And I'm going to go through them pretty briefly today, but happy to elaborate in future episodes. So human flourishing standard. This is the most subtle thing, but the most foundational thing. When I'm talking about assessing any kind of technology, I'm assessing its capacity to impact our values or my values. And then the first question is, what are our values? And another way of thinking of this is, when I'm assessing a technology, there has to be some ultimate goal. What am I trying to achieve by assessing or evaluating Facebook? What am I trying to achieve by assessing or evaluating a smartphone? What am I trying to achieve by assessing or evaluating fossil fuels? And for me, and on this show, the ultimate goal is always some form of human flourishing. I want to do this in a way that helps me and other human beings live to our highest potential. That is the goal. And because that's the goal, then when I look at the different capacities of something, I'm always looking at, how does this affect human flourishing? How does this affect human flourishing? How does this affect human flourishing? And let's take the issue of fossil fuels. If I'm looking at the, say, impact of CO2, which is right now a necessary byproduct of fossil fuels, my standard is, how does this impact human flourishing? So how does it impact human flourishing to put more CO2 in the atmosphere? If that warms things, how does that affect human flourishing positively or negatively? If that affects precipitation, how does that affect human flourishing positively or negatively? Et cetera, et cetera. But part of that is, I'm interested in that, but it's not, I'm interested in the full capacity. So I'm interested in how does it affect, how does CO2 affect human flourishing? But then I'm interested in how do all the other aspects of fossil fuels affect human flourishing? And then how do they all interrelate? For instance, let's say CO2 makes a certain place that had a perfect temperature, which most people don't experience, a little warm, but then it also gives the people at all temperatures more ability to make any temperature comfortable. So that's the kind of consideration when you're looking at the full capacity. Now, it might seem like, oh yeah, this is obvious, right? Of course we want to look at it in terms of human flourishing. Of course that's the goal. But actually what I've observed with thought leaders is that is not their goal. First of all, there's almost never a discussion with assessing technologies of what the goal is. And then when there is a discussion, usually the goal with fossil fuels, if there's any stated goal, is the goal of being green, which means the goal or standard of minimizing our environmental impact. If you see the discussion over fossil fuels and CO2, there's not really even much discussion of the potential benefits of energy to human flourishing. The whole discussion, in fact, is defined as climate change. People take it as, oh, we're talking about climate change. But from a human flourishing perspective with fossil fuels, climate change, which is a vague term, but say the climate influence of CO2, that's just one piece of the puzzle of fossil fuels. But because people are focused on being green, then that goal is minimize our impact on nature. And then the whole focus is, oh, are we impacting nature or not? Is CO2 impacting nature? How much is it impacting? Do you believe it or you deny it? So Interestingly, the whole discussion of fossil fuels has been focused by this standard of being green on only the potential environmental impacts of fossil fuels. And then within that, the whole focus is just impact is bad versus from, so we say, is climate change real? Oh, if it is, it must be bad. Versus from a human flourishing perspective, some climate influence might be good, some might be bad, it might be a big deal, might be a small deal, and it all has to be integrated with all the benefits that exist from fossil fuel energy, including the benefits of protecting ourselves from climate. But because people aren't on a human flourishing standard, they're on a green or unchanged nature standard, even the way the whole question is framed is as, oh, our only goal is let's not impact nature. And thus people miss this whole set of potential benefits to human flourishing. And this is exactly what happened with the thought leaders for 40 years. All they could see, particularly in the ones who are focused on climate, was, oh, this might impact nature. So let's just focus on that. And then if it does impact nature, or if it might impact nature, then let's radically restrict it, right? Because we don't want to impact nature too much. We know that that's bad. That's the goal. We don't want to impact nature. And what they did then was they were proposing something that would radically reduce human flourishing. And yet they weren't even really aware of it. Certainly people listening to it, institutions, were not even aware that the goal being pursued in assessing fossil fuels wasn't human flourishing. The goal was actually just to minimize our impact, and therefore people weren't even really assessing fossil fuels. They weren't paying attention to the energy of fossil fuels. They weren't paying much attention. They were just paying attention to environmental impact. They were just paying attention to, quote, climate change, and thus they were willing to make prescriptions that would say, let's deprive people of all these benefits that we're not focused on because we want to minimize our impact of nature in some way. So I think you can see here, if you agree with my analysis, that not having a human flourishing goal, and then especially if you have this goal of minimizing impact, which is really an anti-human flourishing goal, that can just change your whole assessment. So you don't even pay attention to all these things that are crucial to human flourishing. Now, I realize I'm trying to keep these shows a little bit shorter than I did at the outset. So what I'll do is I'm just going to summarize the others really, really quickly. The standard is the most important one. And then I will, I'm happy to elaborate on this next week, particularly if people like it. But the three others are even-handedness, precision, and explanation. And all of these are also lacking in terms of our knowledge system. So there's people aren't clear about the goal and the standard and that it should be human flourishing. That's the biggest thing. But then as part of that, if the goal is, whatever your goal is, and let's say it's human flourishing, a key virtue is I need the assessment that I get to be even-handed. I need to look for all the benefits and risks, all of the capacities to positively or negatively impact human flourishing. I can't just look for positives or negatives. And you see all the time on the fossil fuel issue, either sometimes people on quote unquote my side will ignore potential negatives, and then certainly people on the other side will ignore potential positives, and they will make very, very overly optimistic assessments of solar and wind. So even-handedness is a big virtue that is very lacking. People aren't even trying to do it because they don't have it as an idea that this should be an explicit guideline. Part of even-handedness is precision, is I want to look at all the benefits and risks, and then I want to look at them with precision. And this, there are at least two important dimensions. One is I want precision of magnitude. How big is something? So if there's sea level rise, how big is it? Is it 2 feet in 100 years like the UN says, or is it 20 feet in 30 years like Al Gore says? That's going to make all the difference in terms of evaluating and making decisions about a technology. And then there's also probability. If someone talks about some scenario, really how likely is that, if at all? But if you just say really vague things like, oh, climate change is real, you're ignoring the need for even-handedness in the sense of you're not talking about the benefits, and precision, you're not talking about the magnitude. And I see this everywhere in medical things. You see this. People are just not even-handed when they're assessing digital technologies. They're not even-handed and precise. It's just a mess. And thus we cannot get a good assessment. But if we have these principles of assessment, we know we want a human flourishing standard. We want even-handedness. we want precision. What we're going to find is there are only a few people who are even claiming to do that. And then that helps the universe a lot, that there aren't even that many people claiming to do it. And then the question is, when people claim it or some portion of it, how do we handle that? And I've talked a bunch about this. This is the issue of what I will often call knowledge acquisition systems. How do we validate claims? And this is a huge issue, but one really important shortcut, which is the fourth principle of assessment I mentioned earlier, is explanation. And this is just to demand an explanation of how people know things. We just need to be on the premise that if you are going to tell me that something is right as a specialist, you need to clearly explain your validation process, and that includes assessing plausible counterarguments or questions that people have. And so many people fail this test, even when they're giving anything that looks like a human flourishing based, even-handed, precise assessment. There's so little explanation. So what I find when I'm assessing an issue like the fossil fuel issue, I find this is really good for me to practice, for me to have in mind, for me to hold myself to. I need to overall try to understand the full capacity to impact our values by having, one, a human flourishing standard, two, practicing even-handedness, three, practicing precision, and four, practicing explanation. But then when I'm consuming content on all of these other things, I have an idea of, okay, this is what it means to have a good assessment of something, and then demanding a very high quality of explanation. So on any given issue, particularly one, if I want to spend 10 or 20 years on it, I can work it out for myself. But what I would really like is for these principles of assessment, or whatever form I end up with, to become norms, so that in our society, with all of these different complex, controversial technologies, we are in a much, much better place. So that is my thought for the week. Eager to know what you think. If you want to email me, I'm at alex@alexepstein.com, or you can give feedback on the Facebook page at facebook.com/humanflourishingproject. If you want to sign up for the mailing list, go to humanflourishingproject.com. Hope you enjoyed this week's thoughts, and I look forward to talking to you next week. Okay, until then, I'm Alex Epstein. This has been the Human Flourishing Project.